and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, author and columnist for the Anchorage Daily News, Elise Patkatuk. She was recorded speaking on her experiences as an opinion writer in Alaska at a luncheon hosted by the Alaska Professional Communicators on January 3rd. Listen to Elise Patkatuk coming up next on Addressing Alaskans after the news. This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with author and Anchorage Daily News columnist Elise Patkatuk. She was recorded speaking to the Alaska Professional Communicators at Kinley's Restaurant in Anchorage on January 3rd.
Elise is a fabulous speaker. We've had her here before as a scheduled speaker. And she has her own column. You all recognize it from the weekly one in the paper, which seems to have moved to Thursdays now.
Just the two holidays.
Oh, okay. I was confused because I looked on Wednesday like I always do for the first thing. And but it is a fabulous article. It's so common sense and down to earth, and I just absolutely love the writing that Elise does. She has a book out, Parallel Logic, and I understand possibly a new one in the works that we'll certainly look for. Of course, it's not a fast procedure to have a book come out, but that's exciting too. And the other thing that Elise may not tell you that she does a marvelous job, she's a volunteer for Bird TLC, which just this week had to actually move everything out of the clinic because they're expecting a spill with oiled birds coming in. The International Rescue Center has that clinic as their own, and they just rent it from them. So probably Elise was over there helping with that too. But she goes weekly and works with these birds and has for years and years. And it's a very wonderful organization. So we're very pleased to have Elise here today and willing to speak. Thank you.
Well, we'll see how thrilled you are when I'm done. The first thing I want to say is, yes, I'm a volunteer at Bird TLC, and since I'm doing this as a favor at the last minute, I'm going to take a moment to make a pitch for Bird TLC, which is on the Pick, Click, Give website. The reason that we had to pack up and move, and I mean literally, it was New Year's Day, it's my regular shift day. They sent out a notice that we had to take down the entire facility, all of our stuff, which meant literally taking down huge mews and collapsing them. And even though it was New Year's Day, the word went out because I was there with like two people for my regular shift, and people poured in the doors. And within hours, we had that place collapsed. But if you all think of us with a pick, click, and give, and we make enough money, we can have our own facility. So the next time, and hopefully there won't be one, but if there ever is another spill, IBRRC, the International Bird Rescue Group, can have their own facility already, and we aren't in it, and we would have our own facility, and we wouldn't have to be crating up eagles and owls and calling and begging people, can we put a raven in your garage? Can we put a magpie in your backyard? How do you feel about eagles in your living room? We could avoid those. Yeah, we can avoid all those questions. So that's my pitch for Bird TLC. Having been asked at the last minute what to talk about, I thought, given my column today and the response I've already had to it, and I'm hoping nobody here is armed, we could talk about what it's like to be a columnist in a state where perhaps your viewpoint is not necessarily that of many other people in the state. Writing controversial columns used to be not so scary because, with before the internet and before the paper went online, if people wanted to comment or respond to what you wrote, they actually had to take pen to paper and write a letter and send it to an editor who then decided it did or didn't go in the paper and it did or didn't get edited. Nowadays, if you go and read the paper online, you'll notice that right at the bottom of any piece is a place where you can comment. So whatever first thought floods into your head, there is no longer a censor between that thought and its appearing in print, which means that if you look at the bottom of, say, one of my columns that perhaps has raised some hackles, you'll find anywhere up to 200 or 300 comments from people, most of whom don't agree with me. I should add, because it's the people who don't agree with you that tend to write a lot more. In fact, there's some people whose names I see constantly at the end of my column who really hate what I write but are actually my biggest fans, because they obviously read me every week no matter what I write, so that they can get upset and send a comment into the paper to comment on what I wrote. Unfortunately, the downside of that, I mean, it's kind of fun to have an interaction such as it is with people commenting on what you're writing. Unfortunately, sometimes it can get very nasty and personal, and because of that, I tend to try and keep my address and phone number as far away from the public as I possibly can. I have gotten letters to my house. I've had phone calls from people. It's a very interesting thing to be a columnist in a state like Alaska, where, God bless the people here, as in my home state of New Jersey, they have no problem expressing themselves when they want to express themselves, whether it is a positive or a negative expression. So, for instance, two weeks ago, I believe, I wrote a column about assault rifles. I'm sure that I knew it was going to get controversy here in this state, because this is a state of gun owners. I thought that I made it very clear that what I was talking about was assault rifles with multiple clips that create carnage. I don't know, when I lived in Barrow for 30 years amidst many hunters, I do not know of any hunter that goes out after a caribou with an assault rifle. Because if he did and he brought the remains home to his wife to cook, he would have a lot of trouble explaining what he was bringing home and how many bullets she had to dig out of it, or fragments. I mean, hunting is a perfectly acceptable, normal way of life. We've been doing it for millennia. It's how human beings survived. Assault rifles are not hunting rifles. Well, depending on what you're hunting. But at the end of my column, if you looked on the online site, the hate mail that flowed was unbelievable. And most of it said that I was trying to take people's guns away so they either couldn't protect their family or couldn't hunt for their family. No differentiation made between something that is a legitimate need and something that is usually meant just to kill. On my way in, I was listening to NPR, because I'm on the board of KSKA, so I always have NPR and KSKA tuned in on my radio dial. Neil Conan was interviewing a gentleman who wrote a piece in the New York Times recently, a column in the New York Times on Monday, in which he said that the Constitution is not sacred. That something that was written 250 years ago by people who lived in a world in which women couldn't vote, it was okay to own another human being, and someone without property should have no say in civic life, were not necessarily people who could speak to our needs today. And by tying ourselves up in that, we were limiting our ability to make our government move with the times and be sensitive to our needs. Whether you agree with this or not is not the point. The point is, the gentleman said within 2 days of him, this column appearing, he had over 700 emails in his inbox, many of which he said were violently threatening, violently anti-Semitic, he is Jewish, and some of which just basically warned him about what was going to happen to him in the future. That's kind of the stuff, if you're going to be a columnist, that comes with being a columnist, unless all you're going to write about is flowers and birds. Today I wrote a column about marijuana. Here's my take on this. Before I die, and I'm getting close to that age, I have two goals I have left in life. One, I want to vote for a woman president. Two, I want to walk into a store and buy a legal pot brownie. I come from the 60s. Those are my two goals, right? I was never a drinker, so pot was my drug of choice. And it is a drug, as is alcohol, which people would prefer to not think about. So that's the column I wrote today, and if you go online and see the comments at the end of it, once again, I have apparently suggested that we overturn society as we know it and become some horrible, dysfunctional group of people who are always stoned out of our minds. And let me tell you, I've been around people who are stoned out of their minds. They're not half as dysfunctional as alcoholics, or half as scary, or half as nasty. So that's what I do for a living, and I have to say that in all the years of being a columnist in Alaska, and my first column appeared in 1989, I've written for papers throughout the state, from Fairbanks to Anchorage to Barrow to Kotzebue. I have appeared in I think Southeast is the only area where a column of mine doesn't normally appear or hasn't appeared in the past. I've learned a couple of things about writing a column. One, you can't be afraid. If you truly believe in a specific point of view and you have the guts to put it out there, you have to put it out there and be honest. You can't hedge it. I learned this very, very strongly when I wrote for the Voice of the Times for a few years. Anyone who knows me knows that my political philosophy probably was not the Voice of the Times political philosophy. But Paul Jenkins, who many people view as like the right-wing spokesperson for everything and the oil companies, was one of the most respectful editors I ever had. The Voice of the Times, whether you like their politics or not, understood free speech, First Amendment, and the need for everyone to have a place to express themselves properly. They never edited me. They never told me I couldn't write on that topic. They never told me I couldn't take this perspective, even if it wasn't the perspective of Vika or the oil companies or anyone else that people thinks they represented. I can't tell you how much I respect Paul Jenkins and the people he worked with for doing that for me, because they gave me a place to express what was in, and they had very little space. If you remember the Voice of the Times towards the end, they had like a half a page in the Anchorage Daily News, but once a week they let me express my viewpoint there, even though it was frequently not their viewpoint. And I expressed it. And you have to have that belief in your conviction. You also have to have a major ego, because you have to believe, and I really do believe, if the world would just listen to me, golly, would I be able to just straighten out all your problems? And you need to have that. You need to have some of that in order to write a column like this. You know, because the kind of column I write isn't a Julia O'Malley column. And let me start by saying I adore Julia's work. She writes a different kind of column. I write a specific opinion piece. I'm telling you what I think and why I think I'm very right, and the rest of the world who doesn't agree with me is wrong. And you really need to have the kind of ego that can stand up to people walking up to you in public when you're out grocery shopping and tell you that they think you're an idiot. Yeah, I mean, you are a public figure. They insist on putting your picture with the column so people can recognize you. For years, I had a picture in the paper that was about 30 years old, and I thought, well, they won't recognize me because I don't look like this anymore. And then I had to put a new one in, and now everyone can see who I am. So being a columnist of the type that I am is a challenge. It's a challenge because you know you're putting yourself out there. You're losing all your privacy. People know what you think and what you stand for. And for a lot of people, that's very uncomfortable. It's like when they walk into the polling booth, the voting booth, they vote because it's private and no one knows what they're doing. Pretty much anyone who reads my work kind of can figure out who I'm voting for on a good day. You give up that privacy, and that is hard for a lot of people to handle. My reaction to it, the way I handle it, is I stay home a lot. I really do. I don't go out. I don't do a lot of socializing. I tend to stay home a lot because it's safer there, and my dogs like me. And not one of them has ever come up, and of my birds has ever come up to me and called me an idiot. They may want to, but they know better because I control the food source. The other thing about being a columnist that I have found just possibly the most difficult part of the whole thing is getting up on a Monday morning and staring at a blank document on my computer and thinking, what in the heck do I have left to say that anyone gives a damn about or wants to read? And there are times when, well, for instance, this past year, the Republican presidential nomination fight, the primaries, you could get up on Monday morning and type with one finger while drinking coffee and have a column out in 10 minutes. I mean, they were just a wealth of material. Whether you were for or against, the, you know, whether you're Republican or Democrat or independent, you can't deny that the Republican nomination process this year was one of the most amusing things that we've had come down the pipe in a long time. You know, Donald Trump, hello. I mean, he was running for president, Donald Trump, really? Really? You know, what was the thing on his head was running for vice president? What? I mean, some of the people that were running were just that they kept the words flowing, and then all of a sudden it was over. And one day you're staring at your blank computer screen and you're thinking, well, wait a minute. There isn't a funny nominee to write about. Now what am I going to write about? The politics are over. It is a scary, scary moment. I start thinking about this usually before the weekend even begins. My deadline is Tuesday for a Wednesday column. And by Friday, I'm already close to panic, thinking, oh dear God, there's nothing left to say. I'll never write another word. I'll never have another good idea. And sometimes I have literally sat down and just started typing on the paper without having any idea where what I was typing was going to go. A weekly deadline scares me. I think of people like Julia and Mike Dugan, who did three times a week their deadlines. Mike especially, who was just amazing. But he did this three times a week. I mean, it's not reporting. You're not going out and finding someone and asking them questions and writing down what they said. All of this is coming out of your mind. And from what we saw come out of Mike's mind, wow. It was just amazing, and that makes writing a column, to my mind, and I'm not praising myself for this, but I think it's one of the more difficult creative processes that you can go through, because you are constantly digging down in the attic and the basement and wherever part of your mind where it's dark and maybe you don't have a lot of light because you shouldn't, trying to come up with one more idea, one more clue, one more kernel of something that you can put and make 700 words and make it interesting, make someone want to read it. It is an weekly exercise that I personally think, were Alzheimer's or senility to strike me, this is what will hold it at bay, because it exercises my mind so much. Now, having said that, let me tell you, there are a whole lot of people out in the reading public of this town who will say, really? Really? You exercised your mind to come up with that stupid idea? Well, yes, I did. Yes, I did. It may be stupid, but it's mine, and I still had to come up with it. I think, you know, I'm open to questions here. Yes. Oh, wow. Okay.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Elise Potkatuk, author and columnist for the Anchorage Daily News. She responded to questions from the audience following a talk she gave to the Alaska Professional Communicators on January 3rd.
Okay, I'm going to repeat your question because we are taping this for broadcast and it's hard to hear. The question was, when I came from New Jersey, which is clearly a different state than Alaska, how did I come up with my political philosophy and how did I meld it with this state from where I came from? I came here in 1972 as a nurse. I had no clue I was ever going to write for a living. I knew I loved writing. I had always written. But career advice in my family consisted of two statements. One, become a nurse. Someone will always hire you. And back then, women had nursing, teaching, secretary were your three career paths. And two, work for the government. They can't fire you. That was considered career advice. So I went up to Barrow. I went from New Jersey to Barrow in 2 days and never stopped anywhere else. And so my first absorption of the state of Alaska and its culture and people happened in an Inupiat Eskimo village on the North Slope at a time when there was only three planes a week that came in. There was no newspaper, there was no TV, there was no radio. So I absorbed a very specific culture that as the world opened up and the internet came and newspapers came up and TV, I started realizing wasn't really the culture necessarily of the rest of the state. So for me, the process of becoming who I am politically and socially and with my work in social services, it was a very long and gradual process, because first I absorbed being part of this very traditional Eskimo community, and then as my world widened, I met the rest of Alaska, and I found out that the rest of Alaska viewed where I lived as a foreign planet. I mean, I would be in Anchorage and people would say to me things like, "So those native people, they get checks from the state just to live, right? Every month the state sends them a check." Well, no, the state doesn't. Yeah, they do. I know that. I know. And the federal government, they let them live there for free because they send them money. Well, no, they really don't. These are very poor communities for the most part. But people in urban areas of Alaska, and it's not as bad now, but again, because of how much media and communication has opened up. But when I was first up in Barrow, the concepts of urban Alaskans concerning bush Alaska, just, it was mind-boggling. You didn't know where it was coming from. So all that kind of came together. And let me give much credit to the Inupiat people I lived with for 30 years, because their philosophy of life, as hard as their life was and as difficult as the infusion of oil and money made it, and as many social problems as existed, they never lost a core value, their core culture. And I watched them go from having so many problems to now having like a junior college up there on the North Slope in Barrow, to having an Inupiat Cultural Heritage and Cultural Museum, to having dance groups that go all over the world, to fighting for all they could to hold on to what was the best of their culture. And anyone who's lived in bush Alaska, and this isn't just for the Inupiat, this is for anywhere in the bush, you have to be amazed at the strength of people, because there's so much sadness and pain in the bush. We know the suicide rates. We know the sexual assault rates. We know the abuse rates. What you don't hear so much about is what still exists that's good, that people are clinging to, and that I do believe someday will be the kernel that they'll build their new world around. So that really, really touched me and really made me understand things that maybe I had never understood before, because I grew up in New Jersey in a very, very different world.
Next, a person from the audience asked Elise what she knew about the famous whales of Barrow featured in the film Everybody Loves Whales.
Here is my memory of the whales. First of all, what you need to understand is the Inupiat people hunt whales. The Inupiat people do not eat the type of whale that was stock, the gray whale that were stock. First of all, it had been years since they had been that far north. This was a new migration that seemed to indicate the population was getting healthier, that they were coming back to areas where they hadn't been seen for a while. Had the media not gotten hold of this story, in all likelihood, what would have happened is, rather than watch these animals suffer, they would have been harvested, because there was no way out for them, and they were just going to die. Once the media got a hold of it, it became a whole different story, because the Inupiat people had already dealt with horrible publicity generated by a John Denver special many years ago, about whaling, where they had opened up in one of our villages to his TV crew, and he had gone and done a story that was just not very nice and not very respectful of a very traditional cultural activity. So when the media got a hold of this, the Inupiat people stood back and said, whoa, whoa, we aren't going to be on national TV, international TV, as whale killers, you know, these wonderful animals, and we're killing them. My knowledge of the media at that time was limited, but here's what we saw in Barrow. The guys come up, and they were mostly guys. The reporters had come up. First thing they'd find out is Barrow was a dry town. There were no bars. This upset them to a degree I can't even begin to explain to you. The second group of people who came up, the TV, the technical crews, their bags rattled with liquor. I mean, it was just like, oh my God, bring bottles. We have nothing here. The talent, the in front of the camera people, they would go out maybe once to where the whales actually were and realize that, hey, it's very cold out here. It's dark. The wind is blowing, and oh my God, this truck just drove me over ice and I'm standing on the ocean now. I'm not happy. So what we saw them do was there's a hotel, the Top of the World Hotel, where everyone was staying. If you came out and you stood at the corner of the Top of the World Hotel and angled your camera just right, you had the Chechi Sea behind you and all the ice of the Chechi Sea. Well, ice is ice. I mean, who the heck knows if it was the ice from the Beaufort up north or the Chukchi to the west of us, it was ice, right? They would come out of the hotel and do their reporting there and pretend that they were out where the whales were. The only people towards the end going out to actually where the whales were the film crews, the guys doing the actual filming, until the Russian icebreaker showed up. And then, of course, well, now we need FaceTime, and so we go out there. But that was our memory. I mean, we would sit, the people who lived there, we were kind of laughing because, you know, you'd see these guys standing there and their hair would be like frozen in place because they had so much crap on it because the wind would blow it. And they would stand there just shivering and they couldn't move too much because if you moved this way, you saw a telephone pole. And if you moved this way, you saw someone's house. So they really had to kind of stand right there for the shot to get the ice in the background. Aside from that, we were happy to have them up there. There was a great infusion of cash. God bless them. They were willing to go to our schools and talk at our schools. They did some wonderful stories about some of the activities of the kids in the schools. Anyone with a pickup truck made money because they would pay $100 to drive, and I didn't care, it was the company money, right? $100 drive you out to where the whales were. So it amused us. I mean, it was November. George H.W. Bush was running for president against Dukakis. It was the most boring presidential election in recent memory. And this was something that, you know, it was fun. It kept us amused. The movie, I haven't seen the movie because I was doing some background for the producers and the people making the movie. And I found out that Drew Barrymore was down at the Seward Sea Life Center, or down in Seward, going underwater in a wetsuit for a scene in the movie. Now, if you've seen this movie, you've seen this scene. Nobody goes underwater in the Arctic in a wetsuit in November and wants to come out alive. It don't happen. I mean, and that just was like, oh, and they were like, well, you know, we got to do it. Drew's cute and she gets to wear a really tight little wetsuit. And it's, and I was like, okay, so maybe I'll just keep my memories of having lived through it and not go watch the movie. And that's what I did.
Another audience member asked Elise to talk about the book she's working on right now.
Well, yes, it's titled, as I recently told my editor, the book, or the publisher, the book that I'm determined to finish. That's its working title. If anyone has read Parallel Logic, my first book was pretty much, and let me start by saying, people who write fiction leave me in awe. Charles Dickens, I view as a god, and anyone who knows me knows that I reread his books routinely. I can't imagine having all those people living in your head out of nothingness. I mean, you create them pretty much out of whole cloth and you make them come alive. That just blows my mind. I can't do that. So my first book, Parallel Logic, was about my 30 years in Barrow, my 28 years in Barrow. It was a memoir. The second book is pretty much about someone from Bush, Alaska, moving to the city and adjusting to life in an urban area. Knowing, for instance, that you don't have to pick up 4 cases of toilet paper from Costco, because next week, if you need toilet paper again, you can just drive to Costco, right? When you're from the bush, you go into a place like Costco and you come out with one of those carts, right? And it's piled to the top because it's going to be 6 months or so maybe before you come out again. So this is going to be a memoir about adjusting to life in an urban area where you can get, you know, sushi that isn't whale. You can get, you know, we called it whale and barrow, you know, where you can get toilet paper all the time in big cases, just things like that, where you can go to a movie. I mean, I hadn't been to a movie in forever. Things that you missed in the bush, restaurants. We had restaurants in Barrow, but it was kind of like, you know, the restaurant that served pizza, Chinese, and sushi. You know, it's kind of an international flavor to the restaurant right before it burned down. So that's what this book is basically about. It's a memoir of readjusting to life in an urban area after so many years in the bush. And I don't know when it's coming out. It's done, and I have a young cousin who has a master's in fine art who edited it for me and has made some suggestions, and that's what we're working on now. We're rearranging some of the chapters to make more sense. Any of you who are writers here know that when you're writing something and you've written it and you've rewritten it and you've edited and you've re-edited, after a while you see what you thought you wrote. You don't necessarily see what's on the page, and you need someone with fresh eyes to take a look at it and say, do you realize that this is not a word? In your head it may look like a word, but it's not a word. And I'm so sorry. Oh, yes. Okay, and again, because this is being recorded, I'm just going to repeat the comment was made, was that he supports the idea that the Second Amendment maybe was written at a time when weapons were much simpler. It was a musket with one bullet in it as opposed to multiple clipped assault rifles now, and that maybe we need to take a look at that and make sense of gun laws. Unfortunately, again, from my column, I have found that there are certain things that I don't know you'll ever be able to get people to talk about without emotions being so high that nothing reasonable is going to come out about it. And gun control tends to be one of those topics. Pot and drugs tend to be another one. There are just some topics that people are so emotionally invested in that you don't end up with a reasonable discussion. What you end up is with people's faces getting redder and redder and redder as they're yelling louder and louder and louder about their point of view, and nobody's listening. Everyone's yelling, nobody's listening. I don't know how you get a reasonable discussion about some of these topics, but as I wrote some years ago about a discussion that we had here at Alaska Professional Communicators over whether or not to have brownies for dessert, having seen, 12 women trying to come to an agreement on whether or not to have brownies and whether we should charge for them, and if we do, how much, and can someone just have the brownies and not lunch, and it took us the better part of a year to come to an agreement on that. I don't see sensible gun control legislation becoming a reality in the near future when you view the current U.S. Congress and its functionality. Yeah, well, the gentleman said that the big problem was the NRA. I don't see that as the problem. I see the problem being people who bow down to that pressure without standing up and saying we need to have a real discussion. Politicians running for the hills when the NRA rears its head. Well, the NRA is doing what the NRA is meant to do. It is a gun advocacy group that represents people with an interest in guns. They're doing their job. It's our politicians and other civic leaders who aren't doing their jobs in making reasonable discussions available to people about what might or might not really work. The NRA is doing what the NRA is supposed to do. It's what they were formed to do. That's their advocacy role. It's the rest of us who have to stand up and be willing to be heard also. And politicians who have to not run for the hills. Good luck with that. Yes?
Do you think that ADM
the question was, do I think the ADN or other newspapers or publications will change their comment on the web, their web presence, the comments at the end of pieces? They have to some extent, they do have someone who edits the comments, and you will frequently see a notice that says comment removed. So they make an attempt to walk the fine line between it's your right to express yourself, but this has gone over the line into something that's not acceptable. I think that the problem that they're always going to face with something like that is finding that line. I don't think they're going to change their policy. I think that this is now something that's kind of it opened up a can of worms, if you will. People like being able to comment at the end of something, and especially people who feel they're not heard otherwise. And yes, you're very right. What happens oftentimes, and I've seen this happen with my columns frequently, is what I wrote about matters in about the first three comments. And then the commenters start talking to each other. And then the ones who are talking to each other have people talking to them. And by the time you get to the 50th comment, it has nothing to do with anything in my, they're just having a wonderful discussion among themselves. And, you know, God bless them. It gives them a forum, right? It doesn't hurt anyone. It doesn't cost anything except for some poor guy sitting at the Anchorage Daily News trying to figure out if he should let this comment pass or not.
Another audience question. What do you think has been your most controversial column?
Oh, that's easy. That's easy. I wrote a column when I was still the voice of the Times. In fact, it was the column cited by the Anchorage Daily News when they called and asked me to come over to them when the Times was closing down, about the fact that Native women will never be respected until they're respected by Native men. That so much of the abuse that we see that drives Native women to the urban areas where they become streetless or prostitutes or end up being harmed here starts at home in the villages where men rape and abuse them and other men say nothing about it. Good men say nothing about it. Good men still go hunting with their hunting partner even though the night before he was so drunk he broke his wife or his girlfriend's face apart. And I commented, and my column basically said, until these men stand up and say, no, you do not represent what's best in my culture, and I don't want to associate with you, until Native men started insisting that Native women be respected, and then following through with that by actions in their communities, that Native women were never going to be able to break the cycle of abuse, that it wasn't something women alone could do. And that column got me basically, to some extent, ostracized in Barrow by a certain group for a long time. I got a lot of hate mail. I got people sending, it was unbelievable. It was the biggest flood I had ever seen of mail and comments and people making outlandish comments that told me that they had probably been abused and were trying to suppress the fact. But that was absolutely the most controversial column I've ever written, got the most attention, and ultimately was what had when the Daily News called me, the gentleman who called me, Matt Zensi, said, we saw this column and we thought we would like to have you come over and write for us.
Last, another audience member asked Elise, after your years of work in social service, do you think things are getting better in the bush?
I think things are getting better, but so incrementally that probably there's a lot of people who would argue that point with me. I work with a lot of young people, especially with my work with Illisavik College, and there are some young people there that I know have come from very hard backgrounds who are working their way out of that, who are finding a good life, who are learning to not expect abuse to be part of life. But it's very slow and difficult. No, I haven't seen a major move on the part of the men in these communities to stand up for their women. They will stand up in word, they will stand up in statement, but to me, the bottom line is, if you know this man has abused his wife and his children and you're still making him your hunting partner and you're going out and doing things together, then you're letting him know that it's perfectly okay in the end what he did. And that I find abhorrent. But I do think there, I think that I see improvements. I see little places where improvement happens, and I really think that's, I don't think you ever get like some overwhelming, you know, suddenly the earth shakes and everything is better. I think it gets better this way. One family at a time, one woman at a time standing up and saying, I don't think so, that's not happening to me. And those young people are coming up. I think the saddest thing I ever heard when I was in social services was when I was working with a young child who had been abused, sexually assaulted by a family member, and I asked her older sister, who was out of the house at that point, to testify against this member so that we could stop the abuse on her sister. And she said, I lived through it, so will she. If I say anything, my family won't talk to me. That attitude is starting to change, and that's the brightest hope we've got out there, that attitude is starting to change. Well, that was a happy note. There you go. There was happiness to end this. Thank you, I guess, for letting me speak today. It was...
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Elise Pukatuk, author and columnist for the Anchorage Daily News. She responded to questions from the audience following a talk she gave at a luncheon hosted by the Alaska Professional Communicators on January 3rd, 2013. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.